statutory language and built into to federal law, would this not then mean that it would in effect preempt the state law standards and perhaps other standards that might be in someone's articles and bylaws? And I was nodding my head that, which, as Tom correctly says, doesn't show up on the tapes, that in general, I think that's a, in general, I think that's a fair statement.
But basically, what happens with this resolution, if it is put into federal law, is that we'll have also the state law to work with.
Yes.
Plus a third now.
Yes.
So a board of directors can operate their options or decisions in either one of three methods.
Well, you would have a problem in trying to decide. The basic and very interesting area is that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act mandates that there be corporations and that they be organized under Alaska state law. Right? And the original vision was that there would be certain federal statutory restrictions on these corporations that would supersede state law that would expire in 1991. Now, it will be an awkward arrangement between state and federal law to figure out how to make these two responsibilities gel if Congress keeps changing, extending, and entering the area while still leaving the basic proposition in place that these are Alaska corporations formed under Alaska law and answerable to Alaska's state legal institutions.
Could I just suggest how we proceed here? This is fascinating stuff, but I think where Claude has gotten us is this far, that the resolution, if it were passed, would enlarge the discretion of the board of directors, and they could choose to adopt the standard of passage in their articles under relevant state or federal law, or the discretion given to them under the resolution. I wonder if...
I don't think that's correct.
All right.
I think, first of all, it is not clear, because of the way resolutions were drafted, and of course, Liz, you were more actively involved in this than I, whether when this is finally drafted, it incorporates as an additional limit state law concerning extraordinary acts, that is, or other kinds of things. This may not be exclusively preemptive. So I guess the answer to Claude, if I'm right, and I don't think neither of us know at this point,
I think
is that the board of directors would be constrained, certainly would be constrained by federal law, might additionally be constrained by state law.
No, I think the intention, and again, Charlie, if I'm wrong on this, tell me, but I think the intention, the thrust of the problem that the resolution was trying to deal with was to have federal law preempt so that you would not be restricted by these two-thirds and other types of standards within state law unless you so wanted to be restricted, as Claude points out, but you would not be required to be restricted. I think it was a preemption idea that was the thrust behind. Otherwise, what purpose does it serve?
Well, it may mandate procedures that would not be required under state law. In other words, to some extent, these provisions, and that's why I thought we'd go to them specifically, may require reference to shareholders of issues that would not be required to be referenced to shareholders under state law.
Again, I think I find it a difficult argument to suggest that something that's as significant as some of the changes that are properly inherent in the AFN resolutions, whether or not your stock is restricted, whether or not you are going to change all of the assets from a profit corporation over into a tribal organization, would not be something, one, that conceptually is totally appropriate to take to the shareholders for a mandatory vote, and two, that every corporation has promised that that's what it's going to do. So instead of intellectually discussing whether or not this is something for shareholder discussion and whether it should be mandatory, I think we should take that as a basic assumption, because I cannot, it's very difficult for me to believe that there is one leader in this room who would be saying that he would not take it to shareholder vote, one, and two, that he would not consider that vote mandatory. The problem is, what are the standards of passage?
Could I just suggest that what we do now is this. Monroe's idea is we look at these one by one, and I think we should turn to them. But before we do, Claude, and then David, and then Marlene. I had their hands up.
Okay. Maybe I'll try to clarify a little bit more if I can, my own thinking anyway. Let's take the fictional corporation that its bylaw says one-third, or 33% plus one is a quorum. The best they've ever had in their whole existence is 40%, and they're up against the gun and they want to liquidate their assets. If this was part of federal law, this power of the board to set a minimum vote required by shareholders, they could say, we don't need to go to the two-thirds state law requirement if we want to liquidate our assets. We'll just pass this resolution and set the minimum vote to liquidate our assets. Am I assuming correctly that this would allow that?
I don't think you can make that as an ironclad assumption at all. Unless the Congressional Act specifically addresses the Alaska statute and says something to the effect that notwithstanding the provisions of AS 10.05.2762, I wouldn't make that assumption. All you've bought is an expensive lawsuit.
Okay. Did you have an addendum to that, Elizabeth?
Hopefully short, Claude, which is just that I don't think that the AFN resolution attempted to address the question of liquidation. Therefore, I am at one with Professor Fessler.
Yeah. David Case.
I guess I have a very basic question about the mechanics of all this. What does the board normally have the power to change with respect to articles and bylaws?
Under Alaska's section that I just cited, the board has no power on its own to amend the articles at all.
But it can't amend the bylaws. It
can amend the bylaws. It cannot amend the articles. It is the only, interestingly, under existing Alaska law, we have a peculiar situation. The board alone can propose amendments to the articles. Mm-hmm. Shareholders can't. Mm-hmm. Virtually every other state, shareholders can propose amendments to the articles. Mm-hmm. The board has to propose the amendment. And then under the Alaska statute, it must go to the shareholders and it must receive an absolute two-thirds majority, not two-thirds of a quorum, but two-thirds of the shareholders, period, or the amendment fails.
Okay. And I'm correct in assuming that shareholder voting requirements are not normally parts of bylaws?
No, they are not. And nor can the bylaws override the provisions of the Articles of Incorporation. To a given corporation, the articles are like its constitution. The bylaws are more like the statutory law. Bylaws are easier to change, but they are always subordinate to the provisions of the articles which control.
And bylaws could never contain shareholder voting requirements?
Bylaws could never contain a shareholder voting requirement that was inconsistent with Section 276. They could never set a lower figure, nor could they set a higher figure.
Okay, but the articles could set a higher figure.
The articles are competent to set a higher figure. Okay. They are. And the bylaws probably could contain something that would suggest that the board would take advisory votes of shareholders. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how do you amend the articles, mm-hmm. you amend them under existing state law. And whether the Congress could come along and say, we're going to have different standards for amending your articles in these given areas, is a question as to whether there would be a concession of supremacy to federal law in that area, which increasingly will become dubious. But one thing you want to do as a technician is to make very certain that whatever you ask Congress to do directly addresses the Alaska State Corporations Code so that no one is left in doubt as to what it was that you attempted to accomplish. For that, at least, will conceptually simplify everyone's understanding what's going on and perhaps save you the expense of some very tortuous litigation.
My question really is, does the resolution address the question of whether the board is going to be amending the bylaws or acting by a resolution, or is that something that's just not decided, not stated in the resolution, period?
It's unnecessary. The resolution says the board can determine these matters, and you don't need to look to the bylaws and the articles.
State law requires the board to act through the articles by proposing amendments to the articles and then voting on the shareholders. I assume you've got to be pretty specific if you're not going to do it that way.
But I thought that Elizabeth agreed with Claude that this relieved the board from compliance with state law.
No, the resolution as it was drafted and the concept behind the resolution was basically that all matters that affect major changes of the corporations in 1991 will go to the shareholders. Yeah. Now, the idea of having the director set some minimum votes was not to instill an idea that a smaller amount could pass a specific resolution, but the general discussions that we had about that were that a larger amount would need to take some courses of action, particularly with transfers of assets and things like that. And we were always talking like two-thirds. We, as far as I can remember, never talked about the board setting a smaller amount for passage. It was always the higher amount for passage, and it generally related to such things as transfers of assets. We never did discuss, in fact, the board overriding either the bylaws or articles of constitution. I mean, articles of incorporation.
Elizabeth, did you want to add something to that?
Only that I understand what you're saying was discussed, Charlie, but the actual language of the resolution talks about a simple majority of the quorum, and that's the lowest standard that exists for passage that exists in corporate law. And you do have some reality problems of what degree of participation different corporations have. And
Marlene Johnson.
When we drafted these resolutions, they were in concept only. And the mechanics of what's going to come down is going to be worked out and in the next several months. That was the reason for it. And the reason to get to the concept is the reason we got this language, because of the existing organic documents of the different corporations. And in the explanation that went out with these resolutions, not only does it say that we were trying to get to a minimum, we want the highest vote possible. We were not trying to get by state law at all. That was never the intention of the group. The explanation said that it was a minimum and that it was according to the articles and the bylaws of the existing corporations.
The point is that, Marlene, many corporations do not have anything in their articles and bylaws on these points because they are relying on state statute, because state statute forms the backdrop to most of our articles and bylaws. And I suggest to you that it isn't that the problem that is intended to be solved by that is the real problem. Okay, that many corporations have, it's not Bristol Bay's problem, but I know it's other corporations' problem, which is the low level of participation at a shareholders' meeting. You cannot do what you want to do and meet the statutory requirements that are in state law. And so, of course, you do want to get around them. I believe that that's a legitimate desire. You can't meet, many corporations don't have even two-thirds participation, so how can they meet a two-thirds affirmative vote? Of course they want to lower it.
I wonder if we could go on to look at some of these specific resolutions. I think that the point Elizabeth made has been flagged, and I suspect the AFN is aware of it now.
We're aware of it now. Okay. The next resolution is another one I think that's going to cause a lot of discussion, because it's the stock alienation issue, the opt-in, opt-out issue, essentially. And the way it's worded here, again, as Marlene stated, these are thrown out for discussion, and these are not the final yay nay things, and we will change them to suit what we really need. I might say during the process, the first two or three meetings, we did a lot of discussion like Elizabeth is talking about now, and finally decided unless we have something specific that we can talk about, let's write it all down and go after some concepts, and we can refine it from there. So that's the intent here. This particular resolution, and I'll read it, and then I'll turn the mic over to somebody that can explain it maybe better than I can, is therefore be resolved by AFN and Convention Assembled that the Convention endorses the concept that ANCSA should be amended to eliminate the provision for allowing stock alienation after 1991, but that each corporation has the option to permit alienation of stock under the current ANCSA provision. Be it further resolved that this option may be exercised once prior to December 18, 1991, and thereafter as prescribed by corporation bylaws. There was a lot of discussion on this particular one, whereas a couple of corporations really wanted to maintain the current provisions which permit alienation only by passage or by positive action. There was also a lot of discussion on this one where everybody says, well, what's going to happen to all the little corporations or villages that might not take action? We should maybe automatically put these protections in there, and where they could change them only by a vote of the shareholders or some specific thing. And that was the intent here. This resolution takes the latter view, that the provisions would be automatically, protections would be automatically instilled, and that would take a positive vote of some kind to allow alienation of stock. I don't know what we're going to end up with on this particular one, but that's the idea.
Monroe Price?
I'll just hazard one comment. First of all, it may be that bylaws is not correct. It should be articles. And ultimately, these are the kinds of things that will have to be looked at. This shows, in some way, the interplay between current state law, future state law, current federal law, and future federal law on shareholder voting rights. Under current federal law and current state law, restrictions on the sale of stock would terminate in 1991 with no shareholder vote whatsoever. This provision mandates that the restrictions remain and requires a shareholder vote to remove the restrictions, but requires a shareholder vote determined in the way indicated in the first provision. Now, one could say that that is a higher shareholder voting requirement than now exists, since now no shareholder consent is required under law. This is aside from the question of what a corporation does to remove restrictions. That may not be convincing to some people, but I just want to make that point.
Did you use up all yourself on the first one?
Charlie, would you be willing, or you or Monroe, to just talk a little bit about the second part of the be it further resolved, where we're talking about continuing options to exercise? Just get out whatever ideas were behind that.
Okay. I think maybe if we went to the next resolution, that would kind of address that. Yeah. If you remember yesterday when Tony Strong was proposing some solutions on dissenters' rights, that it may be an option to buy them out in a way, and I think that's partly one of the things that the second part of that resolution would allow.
You mean resolution 84-04?
Well, 02, and then the next one is
03. I mean
03.
Yeah,
and maybe if I can go to that one, and we can throw that around a little bit. Okay. Reading it, the resolved part, that the Alaska Federation of Natives and Convention Assembled endorses the concept that ANCSA should be amended to allow corporations to purchase their own shares before 1991 and during any subsequent period of stock inalienability. Since shares under stock inalienability can't be transferred, and we may have some dissenters' problems or some non-natives that we may want to eliminate through some provisions, we have to have a process to do that, and I think that's what this is attempting to do, and maybe Monroe can or somebody else can elaborate on that.
Well, I think, again, this is a concept. I think it will be hard to draft and hard to execute because there will be problems of valuation, fairness, and some of the problems that Tom mentioned earlier of trying to assure that there's not a wealth poverty distinction in ownership of native shares. I think those have to be addressed by individual corporations and to some extent by the statute. Again, one of the issues is, to what extent should that be an option of corporations to fashion their own mode of dealing with this question, and to what extent is this something that should be dealt with by Congress? And the other questions such as, should these be windows of time for the repurchase of stock, which are discrete and set by law, or should this be a continuing power of the corporation? Questions like that.
Well, could I raise a couple of questions about this resolution? It says that in the whereases, it says in the explanation, even if stock cannot be sold or transferred, a corporation would be allowed to buy stock from its shareholders who want to sell. That would remove some of the pressure on the corporation from shareholders who want to be able to sell their stock. Charlie referred yesterday to the expectation of individual benefit that exists out there. People think they should get something out of this, want to sell their shares. This is not a case of the corporation being able to match an offer from an outsider. This isn't a right of first refusal. This is a right unilaterally for the corporation to make an offer itself at a price that it decides on. It seems to me that's a very far-reaching concept. And if the right to make the offer and to purchase shareholders' stock is is exercisable at any time between now and 1991, you could wind up with a very few shareholders, native shareholders, and a great many native people who are no longer shareholders. Now, I'm just looking at the bare bones of this resolution, but I think that means that it could be the most important of all of these resolutions, maybe I'm the only one here who looks at it that way. But Marlene, would you?
Yeah, I agree. This resolution is going to need a lot of work, but I think the real intent at the time we wrote it was giving an out for those shareholders that don't have voting rights, what have you, and don't want their stock to be not inable, you know, that where they could not sell it or get rid of it, that really want to get out of the corporation. It was not the intention of the corporation ever offering to buy shareholders out.
May I add a little bit to that? A couple of things that we discussed. If we assume the ANILCA provisions for right of first refusal and allowing the corporations to deny the right to vote after 1991 to non-natives, that is part of the thing that Marlene was discussing. Also, there was some discussion at during these retreats of how can we perhaps benefit elders that are not being, you know, not getting benefits out of the Land Claims Act. And perhaps this might be a way to do it. Those were kind of the things that were kind of behind this particular resolution. And maybe you're right, it does need a lot of work to maybe more clearly define what we intended in this particular one to evade the danger that you are pointing out.
Elizabeth, and then Bart.
Like Marlene, I see this resolution as a window rather than, if you like, a continuing kind of thing, because there will be a crucial decision to be made by the shareholders of each corporation which way they want that corporation to go. Granted, this is not a legal event, but BB&C did make the effort to survey its own shareholders, and we came out with a profile where 63% of the shareholders wanted continuation of restricted stock, and 36% did not. Now, as management, it seems to me that our job is to make sure that as we move toward the restricted stock goal, that what is put in the federal statutes is as constitutionally sound as our brains can make it. But secondly, that politically and in an institutional sense, there are, of that 36%, incidentally, I'm not suggesting to you that 36% all want to buy out, because when they're really presented with the choices come the real vote. This is a survey, a poll, not the real thing. But some of those will switch. But among those 36% are some who would like out. And although you've raised the specter, which I think is not only, well, it is a we have two specters, if you like. We have the specter you've raised, which is real. And we have the alternative specter, which we already have, of people who would prefer not to be in the institutions and who are locked in. And when people look at native corporations and they say, well, why are there so many proxy fights, or why is there such unrest? Some of it has to do with some people being locked in who would prefer not to be. And I do not, I guess like Marlene, I do not perceive that this is, you know, an ongoing thing over time where you would have a continual loss, but rather that at the crucial time when the boat is taken, people could make their choice. We do have at Bristol Bay, in some of the villages, we have a tremendous difference in pattern among villages. In some of our villages, such as Chignik, 90% of the people who were originally enrolled in Chignik are no longer there. We have villages like Togiak where it's exactly the opposite pattern. 90% who were originally enrolled there are still there. I would think that would make a significant difference, both on what people wanted and also in terms of how real the specter is that you're laying out from your own experience. And so having different corporations go a different way may not be bad.
Is Tony and then Jerry. Tony Strong.
That there's anything that's facially clandestine in this thing either, except I think that a discussion of this resolution ought to come close in hand along with the new natives provision, because what you have here, if you want to say that this option is exercised with the idea that there's also a backdrop of a first right of refusal that's extended both to the corporation and to the family, and yet it's a limited situation so that you don't have a market that's in fact determining the shares. What you have is, what you end up with is a large corporation with a lot of financial capability, perhaps bidding against the children of this person who is allegedly the beneficiary under these inheritance provisions, who may want to be in, but his parent, who is the shareholder, does not want to be in. You've got a possibility there where you're eliminating their ability to get the shares. And to be fair, I mean, even if the corporation would like to see that child get it, what is he going to do? Are they not going to bid what the true market value is, and therefore the one who wants to get out isn't getting the fair value? And yet the children are stuck in a situation where they can't bid the $500,000 that the corporation is going to be able to get through bond financing or something. So I think that although it's going to add to your problems, those are related issues that ought to be talked about, because from the very first legislative history, I mean, the idea was for a corporation to be a perpetual thing because the intended beneficiaries were supposed to be people who would inherit. And I mean, you want to balance that, though, against the rights that you've given to current shareholders, but notice that your decision is going to affect those who might have otherwise gotten those shares for free through inheritance.
Tony, you're next.
Yes, there was something that occurred to me while the discussion was going on, that as it was stated by, I think, both by Charlie and by Marlene, that one of the, and by Liz, was that one of the reasons for this 8403 resolution was to allow those people who are not current voting or holding their shareholders, but they're not voting shares. In other words, the non-natives who are holding the shares. And I have to tie it in also with what Bart said. It has to be tied in with those people who were born after 1971. The solution I suggested yesterday had some bearing on it as well, about being able to issue shares to everybody who was born, and anybody who is currently holding shares only holds it in a life estate. The problem I see is that this resolution doesn't address the people who are to inherit shares after that window is closed. I mean, if we take the assumption that after 1991, non-natives who are holding shares in the corporation cannot vote those shares, then this resolution doesn't address them, because there will be non-natives who will be inheriting shares after 1991. And if their shares are not votable, they may have the same feeling of wanting to opt out. So I think that resolution doesn't address it, and I think it was an important issue.
Charlie, do you want to answer?
Briefly, it says you would allow this process during any subsequent period of stock inalienability, and if in fact stock inalienability is extended, it would continue to allow that for those people who would not be voting their shares.
My response was that was to the fact that people were saying they perceived it as a window, and as opposed to a continuing authority of the corporation. If it was a continuing authority of the corporation, then those people who don't have a right to vote their shares may have that continuing ability to sell or alienate themselves from the corporation.
I think are looking at it as a continuing thing. Mm-hmm. Additionally, in further resolutions, you remember yesterday we were talking about the percentage of shares that are passing to non-natives, and we said part of that, a large part of that, is a matter of definition because of the blood quantum requirements. In one of the other resolutions, we addressed that particular problem in a fashion, I think, that would allow each corporation to extend some of these benefits to those that would have native blood in them or our descendants.
That wraps that up, Tony?
For apparently.
Gary, and then Ralph.
Looking at what's likely to happen should natives decide to sell their stock prior to 1991 or after that, I think there's some questions that need to be raised here. Thinking back about the effect of the cash payments that were paid out to non-resident shareholders and the sense of unfairness that created among the part of village residents, I see a parallel here. If in fact a significant number of people are able to sell their stock back to the corporation, Justice Berger mentioned the possibility of creating two classes or within the native community, those that have shares and they have influence in the corporation and those that do not. But thinking through this, it seems that if people began to sell their stock back to the corporation, that it might set off some kind of chain reaction. Another point related to this, it seems that the intent of some of these resolutions is to maintain corporate control. In thinking about this, it seems that it might be possible to concentrate on a legislation that would require continual native ownership both in the village and the regional corporation. I don't know if that's a viable approach, but it seems to be one way of dealing with the issue of the maintenance of control within those entities.
Ralph Johnson.
I believe I'm assuming correctly that throughout all this discussion we're only talking about voluntary sales. That is, the shareholder is only going to sell if voluntarily, because the resolution is unclear on that. Okay, if that's true, then the second question, it seems to me that Monroe Price alluded to, and I find a much more troubling one, and that is what value is to be determined, and with closely held corporations' shares, it's exceedingly difficult to arrive at value. I mean, there's just any economist or corporate person here or accountant can tell you, you can take book value, you can take assets value, you don't have any market to determine value, and I gather there is no market as such at the present time, so there's really no way to get at value. And if you ask me if I want to sell my land in Eastern Washington, I say, sure, depends, what's the price? And if you say $50,000, I say, well, it's ridiculous, I don't want to sell. If you say $4 million, I want to sell it. So, I mean, it isn't worth that. I don't have any land like that. But I'm just saying that the price is everything. And it seems to me that unless the resolution addresses the question of value or price or something like that, then it's not a very helpful exercise to go through.
Just before we call on you, Dan, the kind of scenario that concerns me is, suppose in a village you have, as Tony Strong told us yesterday, you have in some villages a family that may dominate the local village corporation, other families that may feel for one reason or another that they might as well sell out, at an offer advanced by the village corporation, and an offer that may bear no relationship to the value of the land, which of course may not be ascertainable anyway, but may not even bear any relationship to the value of the assets apart from the land, the non-real estate assets. There might even be money in the bank account, which would dictate a higher offer than has been made. Well, in any event, people might sell out. They might not get anything like what they should for their shares. Furthermore, once they've sold out, if they're going to stay in that village, it may be that over a period of time they become looked upon as people with no rights to use the corporate lands, and you may wind up with the type of situation that we have in Canada and some other countries, where you have some people who are actually called status Indians and others who are called non-status. They have no status. Well, in Canada, it relates to their status in terms of the special relationship with the federal government. It doesn't relate to private property rights and corporate assets. But here, corporate assets are the patrimony of Native people. That's the at any rate, is there an argument, and it looks like I'm going to get one, but is there an argument for making some kind of distinction between villages and regions in connection with this matter? I'm not really dealing with the resolution. I'm dealing with a question of principle. At any rate, Dan, and then David, and then Charlie.
If David had a specific...
Just a small point, and that is that this is a problem that has already arisen in the lower 48 and allotted reservations, where people have sold their allotments and now are viewed as having sold out their interest in the tribal lands. And that is, you know, it's a division that can occur and has occurred, and as far as I know, in places in the lower 48 for different reasons, different history.
You mean allotments sold between 1887 and 1934?
Sure. Right. And then the families perceived as not having any, they may be members of the tribe and may reside on the reservation and all, but there becomes divisions between traditional people who have perhaps held on to the land at all costs, and now the factions develop between traditionalists and people who have sold their allotted lands.
Dan Fessler?
Well, just a couple of points. If I read, if I'm correctly interpreting Resolution 2 and Resolution 3 together, the proposal would all come down to the idea that the stock would be non-alienable. There's no right on the part of any person to demand of the corporation that it part with current assets in order to purchase the stock. All these resolutions would do would be to say that the corporation would have the power to decide that it would adopt that policy. one thing I think you'd want to be concerned about as to whether the corporation in making the decision would make the decision generally or whether it could make the decision with regard to specific individuals. Because at some point there will be a problem of people complaining of the potential of discriminatory treatment. And as a general proposition, the idea of restrictions on the alienability of stock in corporations has been around for a long time in the American legal experience. It has never been widely received. It's always had rough sledding. There are two basic strains of thought. Those who are opposed to restrictions on alienation try and claim that stock in a corporation is akin to personal property, that property can only be affected by the state in accordance with due process, and therefore there are restrictions which the individual citizen has with regard to anybody's ability to dictate as to what will be done with his rights. And if you're using the law to make the stock inalienable, then those laws have been tested and they have not always prevailed. On the other hand, and perhaps the better reason perspective is that as long as the restriction on alienation is tied to what is called a proper corporate purpose, and it would seem to me that native corporations could quintessentially define proper corporate purposes, so long as the restrictions are reasonably related to that articulated corporate purpose, and so long as they do not amount to a total prohibition, then they have been deemed restrictions which have passed muster. My only caution would be that whatever you ask Congress to do, you'd want to do it with the fullest knowledge of areas of recurrent trouble that you want the legislation to speak out and specifically extinguish as landmines in your future before you start walking around in the twilight in that area, because it can be a problem. And as several people have suggested, the ultimate problem is one of, is there an obligation on the part of the corporation? Must it treat all persons similarly situated in terms of their desire in the same manner? And the other question is, is there a fair price that is being paid? Now, in Alaska, at the present time, if they were to make analogies to your current corporation law, where dissenters' rights are recognized with regard to those people who perfect them for organic changes, the law is very solicitous of the minority shareholder. The corporation has to make an offer. If the shareholder is not happy with the offer, they enter into a period of negotiation over the question of valuation. If they cannot, the shareholder and the corporation resolve that matter, it goes to court where there is a judicial valuation. And if that type of theory were ever seized upon, all I'm suggesting is you could be opening the door for courts coming along and deciding what is the proper and fair price to be paid. And that has with it its own risk and indeed expenses in getting that type of evaluation settled.
Charlie and then Bart.
Okay, without arguing the process for establishing a value, the intent here is, in fact, to be discriminatory. As Gary Anders mentioned a little while ago, that perhaps we need some specific language to guarantee continued native control. And, in fact, that's part of our intention. There's also a couple of more assumptions that I think that we need to speak to. These resolutions are placed out in front, assuming that the corporations will continue to be the organization that survives 1991. There's a resolution in there that allows or that we're requesting the change of assets to other types of organizations. Okay, that's another assumption that we might be able to do that. Okay, our intention is, in fact, to be discriminatory. Now, back to the other point that Tom just brought up about the fact that in villages, families will, certain families, in fact, do control the politics of the region. I think that's, or the village, it's a moot point. That's how it is, and that's how it's going to be. It's like arguing about winter. It's a matter of pure numbers. The larger families are going to control, and I think that to argue that point, it's really a moot point. It's strictly a matter of numbers that's been placed, that develops in any type of society, irregardless. And I don't think that point even needs to come up.
Well, Tony, you raised it first of all, and so we'll Tony and then Bart and then Claude.
I do have a response to that. But I also have another point that really hasn't been discussed at this point, and I don't know if it's ever been brought to the attention of the Commission. The response I have really goes and continues with a discussion I started yesterday about that the structure of the corporations, the way they're set up and the way the votes are cast, does put the power of deciding what the corporation is going to be doing in the hands of a few people, or a majority, the majority, is in a sense, the majority rules. And in you know, certainly in Southeast Alaska, where we have have traditionally had a clan system of governance, that mean to me that when a clan leader wasn't able to take care of their clan members, that clan leader was replaced with another. The system of governance at traditionally was that the clan leaders are the ones that took care of their members, and it wasn't up to a person who was popularly elected by other members of the village or other members of the region, for that matter. So the superimposition of a new structure broke up that decision making, and it took away the authority of the clan leaders. And I suspect that that basic principle is true in other regions as well. I'm not as familiar with the Inupiaq region, but I understand that whaling captains had a lot more say historically over what went on in the village than they currently do, where they do now have some say over the distribution of the wealth that comes with catching a whale. But they don't have the same kind of power that they historically have had over other decision matter, the important decisions of the community. So I do think that it is an important subject for us to address. It does involve the culture, and it does involve the decisions about how assets are to be used and wealth is to be distributed in the communities. Then
you're going on to your new point?
Yes.
I wonder if we could just
sure
wrap this up before you do that. And I was using Tony's observations about villages and Southeast families and so on as an illustration. I think Charlie's right, it's a question of numbers, and that's life. But my point is, whatever the reason for people selling out in a village, if they sell out to the corporation, they may be in the same position as those people who sold out in the U.S. when the were given the right to, when all the reserves were broken up, and